Today, APRA opens the mortgage lending taps. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and prop news with a distinctively Australian flavour. APRA has now confirmed their changes to mortgage lending standards, and they've released an updated guide, the APG 223 Residential Mortgage Lending Standards, July 2019. Now, the main difference relates to removal of the 7% buffer on interest rates, and they've replaced it with, as expected, the 2.5% above mortgage rate buffer. But that's going to be down to the individual lender to apply and police. And this will, to some extent at least, open the taps on mortgage lending. But I think it's also quite important to just understand what APRA is doing here and what the implications may be. And to do that, we're going to look at some of the main points in this guide. Now, it is quite complicated, so I'm not going to go through every point, but I think there are a number of quite critical issues that come to the fore as you go through the document. And before we get into the detail, I should just say this is going to be quite a long post because I think it's important to get to the level of wording in the document and to try and get behind those words and to understand what they really mean. So that's what we're going to do today. So I make no apologies for the fact that this will be a long post. If you want to jump through to the end and hear my conclusions, I'll put the time for that part of this show in the comments below. Now, it's important to understand that this is a, quote, prudential practice guide, or PPG, and it summarises prudent lending practices in residential mortgage lending in Australia. Now, they make the point that it is really a guide. There's no legal force behind this whatsoever. And it's worth highlighting the fact that APRA refers to the Financial Stability Board's Principles of Sound Residential Mortgage Underwriting Practices, which was released a few years ago, though in practice, they have not always followed those guidelines. And basically, APRA says that where residential mortgage lending forms a material portion of an ADI's lending portfolio, or bank's lending portfolio, they should take reasonable steps to satisfy the level of risk is appropriate. And that should include things like risk appetite, things like the way senior management approve that risk appetite, thinking about the information systems to track the risks and to report on the mortgage portfolio. Of course, it's all pretty vague, but that's what they expect at least. And they go on to say that where mortgage lending forms a material proportion of an ADI's lending portfolio, there are a series of steps that people should consider. So for example, when setting risk limits for the residential mortgage portfolio, they will want to consider things like the loans with differing risk profiles, like interest-only loans or owner-occupied loans, the channel of origination, the geographic concentrations, the serviceability criteria, in other words, things like loan-to-income, the loan-to-value ratios, the use of lenders' mortgage insurers, special circumstances loans, such as reliance on guarantors or self-managed super funds, and to what extent the lending policies are overridden within the bank, the default portfolio tolerances and risks, and also the non-lending losses such as operational breakdowns or adverse reputational events aligned to that portfolio. So that's quite a long list, but of course the question is, what is the detail behind it? And they go on to say that in order to establish robust oversight, the board and senior management will receive regular, concise and meaningful assessments of actual risks relative to the ADI's risk appetite. And that information should be provided in a timely manner, whatever timely may mean. And where necessary, it might lead to increased senior management oversight, increased monitoring, increased reviews, increased level of internal audits, stronger default management or collections, and changes to the way that provision and capital is actually managed. Again, all very high level, really. Now, they go on to say that from a serviceability standpoint, lenders must accurately assess the borrower's ability to service and ultimately to repay a loan without undue hardship. And that includes consideration of periods of economic stress. And the serviceability tests should be used to determine whether the borrower can afford the ongoing servicing and repayment costs of the loan for which they have applied. Now, that's quite important, particularly on the repayment side. So it isn't just sufficient to service the loan. There has to be a plan to repay the loan as well. That's quite important. And in many cases, up until now, repaying the loan has been far from front of mind. And very importantly, APRA says that the assessment has to be made again if there is a significant change. And that could include, for example, switching from a principal and interest to an interest-only loan or vice versa, or an extension of existing interest-only period, a change from a fixed rate to a floating rate loan, or an extension to the tenure of the loan. Now, all of those will require a new serviceability assessment. And that is to take account of any changes that may increase the total repayments over the life of the loan, even when immediate period repayments are lower than under the previous loan conditions. Interesting question. How many lenders do that, I wonder? And they go on to say that loan serviceability policies will include a set of consistent serviceability criteria across all mortgage products. A single set of serviceability criteria would promote consistency by applying the same interest rate buffers, serviceability calculations, and override frameworks across different products offered by a bank. And where a bank uses different serviceability criteria for different products or across different brands, APRA expects the ADI to be able to articulate and be aware of commercial and other reasons for these differences and any implications for the ADI's risk profile and risk appetite. So expect to see considerable consistency within different brands within the same bank. So taking the serviceability conversation further, they say that ADIs generally use some form of net income surplus model, or NIS, to make an assessment as to whether the borrower can service a particular loan based on the nature of the borrower's income and expenses. And with regard to income, it's good practice, they say, to ensure that the borrower retains a reasonable income buffer above expenses to account for unexpected changes in income or expenses, as well as for savings purposes. They also underscore that it would be prudent for ADIs to monitor the level of and trends for lending to borrowers with minimal income buffers. High or increasing levels of marginal borrowing may indicate elevated serviceability risks. And they say a sound serviceability assessment model applied to residential mortgage borrowing would include consideration of any existing and ongoing debt commitments, both secured and unsecured, interest rates, an outstanding principal on such debt, and any evidence of delinquency. In addition, good practice is that ongoing serviceability would not rely on longer-term access to honeymoon or discounted introductory rates. And they also make the point that a prudent ADI would include various buffers and adjustments in its serviceability assessment models to reflect potential increases in mortgage interest rates, increases in a borrower's living expenses, and decreases in a borrower's income, particularly for less stable income sources. And APRA expects that the combination of buffers and other adjustments in these models would seek to ensure that the portfolio in aggregate will be able to absorb substantial stress, such as in an economic downturn, or a rising interest rate environment without producing unexpectedly high loan default losses for the lender. But it's important to understand there, they're talking at a portfolio level. So within the portfolio, it is certainly feasible to have particular loans that actually go bad. Now, this is the change that APRA's brought in. It says that good practice would be to apply a buffer over a loan's interest rate to assess the serviceability of the borrower, called the interest rate buffer. The interest rate buffer will be applied to the interest rate on the loan to be paid by the borrower, ignoring any discounted introductory or honeymoon rates offered for a limited period at origination of the loan. This approach would seek to ensure that potential increases in interest rates do not adversely impact on the borrower's capacity to repay a loan. The buffer would reflect the potential for interest rates to change over several years And APRA expects a prudent ADI serviceability policies would incorporate an interest rate buffer of at least 2.5 percentage points. But note, there is now no floor. Previously, it was a floor of 7%. And that means that in some cases, lenders will be able to offer bigger loans to borrowers, providing they meet other serviceability requirements. And in addition, APRA says a prudential ADI would use the interest rate buffer in conjunction with an interest rate floor to ensure that the interest rate buffer used is adequate when the ADI is operating in a low interest rate environment. So the question there will be, what floor will lenders use? And it's clear now that rather than having a standard set of guidance from APRA, they're putting the acid back on individual lenders to set this at a level which is prudent and appropriate for them. But of course, there is no way to understand that, and there's no way to measure it or test it until we see defaults later. So this does open the taps for more lending, in my view. Now, APRA says that they expect ADIs to apply the interest rate buffers and floor rates to both new and existing debt commitments. APRA expects ADIs to make sufficient inquiries on existing debt commitments, including consideration of current interest rates, remaining term, outstanding balance, and amount available for a redraw of the existing loan facility, as well as any evidence of delinquency. An ADI is using a proxy to estimate the application of interest rate buffers and floors to the serviceability cost of existing debt commitments would, to be prudent, ensure that such a proxy is sufficiently conservative in a range of situations, updating the methodology to reflect prevailing interest rates. APRA also expects ADIs to use a suitably prudent period for assessing the repayment of credit cards and other revolving personal debt when calculating a borrower's expense. For example, an ADI must assess a borrower's repayment obligation for credit cards or revolving personal debt using a rate of 3% per month on the total committed limit for such facilities. And then they go on to say that for interest-only loans, APRA expects ADIs to assess the ability of a borrower to meet future repayments on a principal and interest basis for the specific term over which the principal and interest repayments apply, excluding the interest-only period. And finally, a prudent ADI would regularly review its interest rate buffers and floors. The method for reviewing buffers and floors will allow an ADI to ascertain whether the current buffer and floor is appropriate in relation to the interest rate cycle, and will take into account historical interest rate movements and interest rate forecasts, as well as key economic indicators over an appropriate time horizon. Reviews, they say, would typically be undertaken on a quarterly basis and when interest rates change. Now let's come to the serviceability assessment. And they say that as part of the serviceability assessment, the ADI would typically assess and verify a borrower's income and expenses having regard to the particular circumstances of the borrower. When assessing borrower's income, a prudent ADI would discount or disregard temporary high or uncertain income. Similarly, it would apply appropriate adjustments when assessing seasonal or variable income sources. For example, significant discounts are generally applied to reporting bonuses, overtime, rental income on investment properties, other types of investment income, and variable commissions. In some cases, they say, they might be applied to child support or other social payments, pensions, and superannuation income. Prudent practice is to apply discounts of at least 20% on most types of non-salary income. In some cases, a higher discount would be appropriate. In some circumstances, an ADI may choose to use the lowest document value of such income over the last several years or apply a 20% discount to the average amount received over a similar period. So there are still tighter restrictions on income than previously. And then it goes on to say that a prudent ADI would be expected to make reasonable inquiries and take reasonable steps to verify a borrower's available income. Verification of a borrower's stated income would normally be achieved through a combination of factors, for example, confirming employment status, reviewing recent payslips, seeking written advice from the borrower's employer, reviewing tax assessments, reviewing bank statements, reviewing other documents, and making independent inquiries into the borrower's credit history, for example, through credit reporting bodies. So quite a long list there, and it's worth saying that 2 or 3 years ago, some banks were not following such a rigorous set of processes around income verification. And then they go on to say that in case of investment properties, common industry practice is to include expected rent on a residential property as part of borrower's income when making a loan origination decision. However, it will be prudent to make allowance to reflect periods of non-occupancy. In APRA's view, prudent serviceability policies incorporating a minimum haircut of 20% on expected rental income, with larger haircuts appropriate for properties where there is a higher risk of non-occupancy. A prudent ADI would also account for a borrower's investment property-related fees and expenses, for example, strata requirements, by including property expenses in estimates of living expenses or by deducting property expenses from expected net rental income. And good practice would be for an ADI to place no reliance on a borrower's potential ability to access future tax benefits from operating a rental property at loss. Where an ADI chooses to include such tax benefits, it will be prudent to assess it at the current interest rate rather than one with a buffer applied. Now let's turn to living expenses, because this is a critical area, and the Royal Commission highlighted that in many cases insufficient access to information and assessment on living expenses was part of normal practice for loan origination. They say a borrower's living expenses are a key component of a serviceability assessment. Such expenses materially affect the ability of a residential mortgage borrower to meet payments due on the loan. ADIs typically use the Household Expenditure Measure, the HEM, or the Henderson Poverty Index, the HPI, in loan calculations to estimate a borrower's living expenses. However, they say, these indices are extensively used. They might not always be an appropriate proxy for a borrower's actual living expenses. Reliance solely on these indices generally would therefore not meet APRA's requirements for sound risk management. That is a very important statement. APRA therefore expects ADIs to use the greater of a borrower's declared living expenses or an appropriately scaled version of the HEM or HPI indices. That is, if the HEM or HPI is used, a prudent ADI would apply a margin linked to the borrower's income to the relevant index. In addition, an ADI would update these indices in loan calculators on a frequent basis, or at least in line with published updates of these indices, typically quarterly. Prudent practice is to include a reasonable estimate of housing costs, even if a borrower who intends to rely on rental property income to service the loan does not currently report any personal housing expenses, for example, due to living arrangements with friends or relatives. So the living expenses side of the ledger is still going to require more investigation and more detail than we saw a couple of years ago. And I think this will limit, to some extent, the bank's ability to lend more and harder. And then they go on to say that a prudent ADI would have effective procedures to verify potential borrowers' existing debt commitments and to take reasonable steps to identify undeclared debt commitments. In addition, it will be prudent for an ADI to retain complete documentation of the information supporting residential mortgage approval, including paper or digital copies of documentation on income and expenses and the steps taken to verify these items. That is a really important statement. So not only do you need to get more information, you need to retain that information and confirm the steps that were taken to verify the information. A few years ago, that was hardly done. This documentation should be retained for a reasonable number of years after origination. Sound documentation practices provide a clear audit trail, demonstrate appropriate verification of serviceability, and can assist in identifying misrepresentations or fraud. Then turning to third parties, mortgage brokers, they say that good practice would be for an ADI rather than a third party to perform income verification. However, if a third party does perform such a role, an ADI would be expected to implement appropriate oversight processes covering income verification. Such oversight would extend to third parties that are granted any form of delegation, even if the ability to approve transactions is within policy limits. An ADI would also monitor and test the integrity of the third-party approval and verification processes periodically, either directly or through operationally independent persons. Now, just quickly on interest-only loans. Borrowers may have legitimate reasons to prefer interest-only loans in some circumstances, such as for repayment flexibility or tax reasons. However, interest-only loans may carry higher risk in some cases, and may not be appropriate for all borrowers. This should be reflected in the ADI's risk management framework, including its risk appetite statement, and also in the ADI's responsible lending compliance program. APRA, they say, expects that an ADI would only approve interest-only loans for owner-occupiers where there is a sound and documented economic basis for such an arrangement, and not based on the inability to service a loan on a principal and interest basis. APRA expects interest-only periods offered on residential mortgage loans to be of limited duration, particularly for owner-occupiers. And as noted above, a prudent serviceability assessment would incorporate the borrower's ability to repay principal and interest over the actual repayment period. Now, my analysis would suggest that only half of interest-only loans written over the last 3 or 4 years would meet this current requirement. So this will continue to put pressure on the interest-only sector of the market. Just now going on to self-managed super funds, they say some ADIs provide loans to property held in self-managed super funds. The nature of loans to self-managed super funds give rise to unique operational, legal and reputational risks that differ from those of a traditional mortgage loan. Legal recourse in the event of default may differ from a standard mortgage, even with guarantees in place from other parties. Custom objectives and suitability may be more difficult to determine. In performing a serviceability assessment, ADIs would need to consider what regular income, subject to haircuts as described above, is available to service the loan, and what expenses should be reflected in addition to the loan servicing. APRA expects that a prudent ADI would identify the additional risk relevant to this type of lending and implement loan application assessment processes and criteria that adequately reflects these risks. APRA also expects that a decision to undertake lending to self-managed super funds would be approved by the ADI at an appropriate governance forum and explicitly be incorporated into the ADI's policy framework. Then they go on to talk about loan-to-value ratios. Although mortgage lending risks cannot be fully mitigated through conservative loan-to-value ratios, prudent LVR limits may help to minimise the risk that the property servicing as collateral will be insufficient to cover any repayment shortfall. Consequently, prudent LVR limits serve as an important element of portfolio risk management. APRA emphasises, however, that loan origination policies would not be expected to be solely reliant on LVR as a risk mitigation mechanism. That is really important. From my analysis of loans made in recent years, lower loan-to-value ratios led to much lighter assessment and validation processes around the loans. They say that a prudent ADI would monitor exposures by LVR bands over time. Significant increases in high LVR lending would typically be a trigger for senior management to review risk targets and internal controls over high LVR lending. With board oversight, APRA has not formally defined high LVR lending, but they say experience shows that LVRs above 90%, including capitalised lenders' mortgage insurance premiums or other fees, clearly exposes an ADI to higher risks of loss. Lending at low loan-to-value ratios does not remove the need for an ADI to adhere to sound credit practice or consumer lending obligations. A prudent lender would seek to ensure that a residential mortgage loan has reasonable expectations of being repaid without recourse to the underlying collateral. An overall sound assessment will be based on the borrower's repayment capacity at the time of loan origination, rather than an overriding presumption that the value of collateral would appreciate. Now, that is a really important statement, because quite often we've seen over recent years the expectation has been that, yeah, it'll be tough initially, but because the value of the property will rise, equity will be created, and that then mitigates risk. APRA has basically said that is not a valid line of argument. And just more on loan-to-value ratios, they say a prudent ADI would exhibit greater caution when relying on collateral values in periods of rapid growth in property price. It may be appropriate for an ADI to strengthen its LVR constraints or reassess its risk appetite in markets exhibiting rapid price appreciation. But of course, they don't really talk about the opposite. What happens when property values fall? And this is a very significant gap in the current guidance, because my belief is that if we see significant changes to property prices, banks should be required to mark those portfolios to market and bring to light the revised loan-to-value ratios. But in fact, that is not advocated by APRA and is not done by the banks. That is a big black mark. They say that sound credit practice would include recalculating LVRs at the time of any top-up loan and other formal loan increases during the life of the loan. Any subsequent refinancing, including a second mortgage, charge or lien, would also typically result in the calculation of a new LVR at the point of refinancing. Such calculations would be based on appropriate and contemporary property valuations. So, that's the point. If there is a further drawdown, a further change, then you should recalculate the loan-to-value ratio. But calculations, they say, will be based on appropriate and contemporary property valuations. Further, particular caution will be needed to be exercised in relation to any drawdown on the equity in the property, especially if the drawdown would increase the current loan-to-value ratio above the level originally agreed. Now, that's a pretty important statement because, of course, we know that quite a few people refinance and draw out capital. Now, until recently, because property prices have risen, that can be done within the current loan-to-value envelope. However, it's unlikely in the current environment that that's going to continue. Therefore, that now requires a more broad assessment. And so, if capital is to be drawn down, and as a result of that, the loan-to-value ratio increases, additional analytics and assessments must be carried out. Now, they also go on to talk about off-the-plan sales, saying that developer prices may not represent a sustainable resale value. Consequently, in such circumstances, a prudent ADI would make appropriate reductions in the off-plan prices in determining LVRs or seek independent professional valuations. Similarly, developer discounts would not be treated as part of the borrower's deposit for LVR calculation purposes. Such discounts reduce the sale price but do not increase the borrower's deposit. And that's a very important statement again, because we know that there have been circumstances where the valuation that has been quoted translates into a much lower true valuation. We've seen property prices fall by up to 30% in some cases off the plan developments. And that means that the loan as originally confirmed was not able to be made because the valuation no longer worked. And they go on to say that where an ADI's receptor allows for higher loan-to-value lending, good practice would provide that the additional risk in this lending would be mitigated by measures such as stronger serviceability-adjusted loan pricing and, in the case of the internally rated banks, higher expected loss provisions and capital. APRA does not consider the sole use of coverage by lenders and mortgage insurers as sufficient control to mitigate or cover high VR lending. Then they go on to talk about stress testing. So basically they say that stress testing arrangements include well-documented policies and procedures governing the stress test program, including timely communication of the stress test results to the board, senior management and other relevant staff. When reporting results, sufficient information will be provided to enable the board and senior management to understand and challenge stress test assumptions and conclusions. This includes quantitative information on the scenario, results, capital impact, key assumptions and recommended actions arising from the stress tests. So I've taken you through there the key main points. And for me, there are three takeouts. The first is that, yep, the buffer has now been changed and that will give some ability to lend more. However, they've really focused in on the serviceability assessment and on the income assessment. And they are still looking for more evidence. And they're saying that simple benchmarks like the HEM won't necessarily be sufficient to be able to approve the loan. And we know that ahead there will be more work done on the loan assessment processes by ASIC, including some public hearings. But trying to understand what the real true implication of all these changes are is really quite difficult, because it really means that the acid now is back on individual lenders to do what they think is prudent. APRA basically has not given very much in terms of firm guidance on any of the key parameters. It's down to individual lenders to set their own policies, procedures, and risk appetites. And we know that some will definitely accelerate their lending and will be prepared to take higher risks. So trying to calibrate the implications of this is quite difficult. But there was some work done by UBS a little while ago that made the point that you've got to look at the changes being offset also by the changes to household expenditure measures. Because there are new HEMs now which are more conservative than previously. And UBS in their earlier assessment, basically concluded that, yep, there were some increases for some type of borrowers, particularly those on low levels of income, but perhaps there will be lower levels of accessibility to loans for those on high gross incomes. And so you've got to take a sort of layered view of how this might play out. My own view is that we will see lending increase. We will see lending increase to first-time buyers, and we will see lending increase to some people who are trying to refinance their existing loans on lower loan-to-value ratios. But I'm not sure that the investment sector will really get fired up anytime soon. And those people with larger incomes and bigger mortgages may find it as difficult as ever to be able to refinance those loans. So if you put the APRA changes, the changes to HEM, and the RBA interest rate cuts all together, my estimation is that on average, we could see lending accelerate by perhaps 3 or 4% over the next few months. And then the question is that sufficient to support home prices? Do we expect them to rise? And the answer is, I think we will see home prices rise in some areas, particularly close into the major centres and particularly houses. Whereas units on the urban fringe and houses on the new estates that are still being built or have been built recently are likely to continue to dive. So yeah, there is some good news here for those who are thinking of borrowing and getting back into the property market. But let's not be too enthusiastic, unlike the property spruikers. Let's be realistic about the changes. But my final point is this. APRA is proving itself to be a wet lettuce when it comes to the supervision of the banks. They've basically thrown out a few ideas in this guidance, but it's not of any legal force. And lenders can take it or leave it. And so it will come back to the culture inside the banks, their ability to be able to deal with their lending portfolios in a way that's appropriate for them. And some will make commercial judgments that they can lend more and lend more riskily. And if many of them do that, we could find that credit growth surprises on the upside. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.